Iran says President Raisi's upcoming state visit to China shows the will on both sides to strengthen political and economic ties. The death toll from the recent earthquakes in Turkey and Syria rises to nearly 36,000 as concerns grow about aid delivery to quake-hit areas in northern Syria. Israeli forces demolish a house in East Al-Quds hours after they killed a 22-year-old Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. And welcome from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Iran's foreign ministry says an upcoming visit to China by President Ebrahim Raisi is a key development in bilateral ties and will hopefully pave the way for closer mutual cooperation, especially in the economic sector.
The trip by Mr. President to China can create a leap forward in implementing plans envisaged by the Comprehensive Cooperation Agreement between the two countries.
Khanani said the 25-year partnership roadmap has already helped bring what he called tangible results in boosting mutual cooperation. He cited a 40% surge in the volume of trade with China in the previous Iranian calendar year. The spokesman added that the president's visit to Beijing shows the will on both sides to enhance political and economic cooperation. Khanani also said several agreements will be signed during the visit. Raisi is heading to China for a three-day visit.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is set to pay an official visit to China at the invitation of his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. The visit will deepen the China-Iran relations, as the two Asian countries have in the past showed their strong determination to boost strategic bilateral cooperation in various fields. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman has confirmed that the Iranian president will pay a state visit from February 14 to February 16. Raisi will be heading a high-ranking delegation, including Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, Minister of Finance and Economic Affairs Ehsan Khandouzi, Oil Minister Javad Oji, and Governor of Iran's Central Bank Mohammad Reza Farzin. The members of the delegation would hold talks with their Chinese counterparts and sign cooperation documents in the presence of Raisi and Xi. Meeting with Iranian and Chinese business leaders and Iranian expatriates are also part of the president's itinerary. Late last year, Chinese Ambassador to Tehran Chang Hao described China and Iran as old friends and new partners, expressing his country's eagerness to enhance all-out relations with the Islamic Republic. He said that China regards the relations with Iran from a strategic viewpoint and will not back off from their resolve to promote a comprehensive and a strategic partnership with Iran, which he called a new chapter in their relations. Raisi's visit is expected to also focus on the U.S.-led Western domination of international affairs, as Beijing and Tehran have a common approach on the issue. The Iranian president's visit to China comes at a time when the world is going through numerous challenges. Nevertheless, Beijing and Tehran have many issues of common concern, such as Afghanistan, regional stability and development, climate change, energy security, and others, which the two sides are likely to put on their agenda of discussions.
President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Beijing comes at a key juncture with Iran, Russia, and China, set to boost their strategic partnership with the aim of standing up to U.S. unilateralism. Now, this carries extra significance as each of the trio has been hit by U.S. economic sanctions.
Relations between Tehran and Beijing go as far back as the ancient Silk Road. The ties are gaining a new momentum due to the West's attempt not only to marginalize Iran under U.S. pressure, but limit China's cooperation with Iran and thwart its economic and political influence in the Persian Gulf region. It seems the Western measures have rather pushed Tehran and Beijing into a new alliance. This can be seen in a lot of repeatedly escalated tensions between the United States and Iran over the past four decades. The U.S. has not only prevented its own firms from trading with Iran since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, but with anti-Iran sanctions also pressured its European allies to follow the same. And that helped Chinese companies move in and fill the void. Over the years, Iran and China have forged a unique partnership that is not easily viable with any other country. China is still Iran's biggest oil client, despite Washington's bid to bring the country's crude exports to a halt. The railway had become a magnet for engineering and rolling stock firms from all around the world before U.S. sanctions in 2018 forced them to withdraw. The pullout left the Chinese with a less contested business terrain. For China, its close involvement in building Iran's manufacturing infrastructure is seen entirely in line with its mammoth One Belt, One Road initiative. Under the same milieu, the two countries signed a landmark 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership agreement in March 2021, defining a unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran. The deal officially documents the Sino-Iranian comprehensive strategic partnership announced during a visit by the Chinese president to Tehran in 2016. It sets the outlines of cooperation, covering major fields ranging from oil and mining to industry, transportation, and agriculture. Both countries have had tense relations with the United States and have sought to project themselves alongside Russia as a counterweight to American power play. The U.S. animosity has also played a key role in bringing Moscow and Beijing together. At this moment, what seems to be of a high urgency for Iran, China, and Russia is to create a united front that could not only serve their national interests, but help bring international peace and stability and protect those countries that are fed with the U.S.-led Western pressure and bullying.
Well, it's 7 days since a powerful earthquake hit Turkey and Syria, and the death toll continues to rise. Over 35,000 people have so far been confirmed dead in the two countries. Officials say some 31,600 people have been killed in Turkey. At least 4,300 also lost their lives in Syria. Rescue workers continue to scour neighborhoods despite freezing weather. Experts, however, are cautioning that hopes for finding people alive grow slimmer with each passing day. Let's cross over to Istanbul, where Rashan Sağlam joins us. Rashan, thanks so much for being with us. Rashan, fill us in on the latest information you have about the situation.
Yes, actually, just 2 hours ago, another 4.7 earthquake took place in the Gaziantep district. This city was also devastated by the earthquakes that happened last Monday, the 7.8 and 7.6 earthquakes. Gaziantep was trying to recover and was one of the cities that quickly recovered from last week's earthquakes. However, a 4.7 was not easy today, and people are still scared. As the search and rescue teams have stopped all rescue efforts when the earthquake happened, as per information coming from the government, and they will continue once things are stable again, because of fear of the rubble or debris of the buildings falling on them, as it happened previously 2 days ago with one of the teams where they were trying to do a search and rescue, and the floor just moved and the debris of a building fell on them. However, they were rescued as well. Now, let me here mention, you mentioned about people coming out alive from under the debris. Actually, miracles are still happening, especially in the city of Adıyaman or the province of Adıyaman. A man and his son were rescued after 177 hours. A four-year-old boy was rescued after 178 hours, also after 177 hours. A young man, 35 years old, in Adıyaman was rescued. And in Antakya, a woman was rescued after 177 hours. So miracles are still happening. And the Turkish rescue teams are still continuing to search for people alive under the debris. They still have hope, especially with this weather. It is easier with the cold weather for people to stay alive more under the debris. Usually it is 7 days after an earthquake happens, but in hotter areas or hotter weathers, Now, due to the cold weather and sometimes due to the snow and rain, people under the debris in a way or another are finding it easier to breathe, to stay alive. And some of them said that they were drinking from the water coming inside to under the debris, to them under the debris from the snow that was falling. So this is a miracle coming from God. Let me just mention some numbers. You mentioned that the casualties have reached 35,000 and more. This is true. 35,283 casualties. The injured are more than 90,000 now. And the teams that are working on the ground to rescue more people are 34,000 working, as per the vice president. And he said that we will not give up on those people who are under the debris until they no longer start hearing people trying to say that they are still there and alive. They will continue the search and rescue. Also, let me here mention that there were more than 2,800 aftermath earthquakes, and strong ones, not ones that are 3 point or something. Most of them are 4.2, for starting from 4.2 until 7.6. So this is a huge number. This is what scares people, and this is why the government have evacuated so far 150,000 people out of those 10 cities to other provinces and other cities safer. And they're sending them to schools, to places where they have set tents. And some of them are now staying in one of the warships that is at the coastal line in Mersin, that they have, the government have transferred it into a hospital.
Okay, Roshan, thank you so much for that update out of Istanbul. Roshan Saklan, their correspondent. The United Nations says a terrorist group in control of a part of quake-hit northern Syria is hampering the transfer of aid by the Syrian government. A spokesperson for the UN Humanitarian Aid Office says aid deliveries are held up over approval issues by the terror group known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. The revelation comes as concerns are growing over the situation a week after two powerful earthquakes rocked the adjoining border regions of Turkey and Syria. Most deaths and injuries from the earthquakes in Syria have been reported in the territory held by terrorist groups. Meanwhile, UN Aid Chief Martin Griffiths lamented the failure of sending desperately needed aid to the quake-ravaged Arab country, saying people there feel abandoned. Griffiths also painted a grim picture of the situation in both Syria and Turkey, saying the current death toll is expected to double, if not more. Moving on to other news this hour, more Israeli bloodshed in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces have killed 22-year-old Amir al-Bustami during a pre-dawn raid in Nablus. Troopers also injured six Palestinians during their incursion. In reaction, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Israeli hostilities are doomed to failure thanks to the heroic resistance of Palestinians. Israel has stepped up its deadly crackdown against the Palestinians, killing around 50 people in the occupied West Bank so far this year. Meantime, the regime's forces have demolished a house in Is al-Quds, claiming it lacked a construction permit. Now, the family who owned the house says that they were not able to get the permit.
We have no criminal record. We have left no way to make ends meet. They did not grant us any permit, construction permits. We want to live. I live amidst an earthquake. There is an earthquake in Al-Quds today. Wasn't there an earthquake in Turkey? And everyone sympathized with the survivors. There is also an earthquake in Al-Quds today. The face of the occupation is the face of mafia, racism, murder, and criminality.
At least 30 Palestinians were injured after Israeli forces stormed the area to destroy the home. Israel regularly raises the homes of Palestinians in occupied territories under different pretexts, including the lack of permits. A report by the UN says those permits are virtually impossible to obtain. Meanwhile, more Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces killed a Palestinian during a pre-dawn raid in Nablus. Troopers also injured six Palestinians during the incursion. In reaction, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Israeli hostilities are doomed to failure, thanks to the heroic resistance of the people. On Sunday, regime soldiers shot dead a 14-year-old boy in the flashpoint city of Jenin. Israeli forces regularly carry out deadly raids in the West Bank under the pretext of detaining Palestinians. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians, killing around 50 people in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of this year. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, Qawwi ala khidmatika jawarihi, Washdud ala al-azimati jawanihi, Wahab liya al-jidd fi khashyatak, والدوام في الاتصال بخدمتك حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the Kumail supplication, states, قَوِّ عَلَى خِدْمَتِكَ جَوَارِحِي Strengthen my limbs in your service. وَشْتُدْ عَلَى الْعَزِيمَةِ جَوَانِحِ Fortify my ribs in determination. وَهَبْ لِيَ الْجِدَّ فِي خَشْيَتِكَ وَالدَّوَامَ فِي الْاتِّصَالِ بِخِدْمَتِكَ And bestow upon me earnestness in my fear of you and continuity in my being's joined to your service. حَتَّى أَسْرَحَ إِلَيْكَ فِي مَيَادِينِ السَّابِقِينَ So that I move easily towards you in the battlefields of the foremost. وَأُسْرِعَ إِلَيْكَ فِي الْبَارِزِينَ And hurry to you among the prominent ones. وَأَشْتَاقَ إِلَى قُرْبِكَ فِي الْمُشْتَاقِينَ So that I desire fervently your proximity among the fervently desirous. وَأَدْنُوَ مِنْكَ دُنُوَ الْمُخْلِصِينَ So that I move near to you with the nearness of the sincere. وَأَخَافَ كَمَخَافَةَ الْمُوقِنِينَ So that I fear you with the fear of those who have conviction. وَأَجْتَمِعَ فِي جِوَارِكَ مَعَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ And gather with the believers in your nearness. In this regard, we discussed some conditions for Allah's special blessings. We said that Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the supplication, sees all the doors of Allah's mercy open to him and the acceptance of his supplication near. So that's why he asks all these valuable and spiritual requests. We said, to gain Allah's special blessings, the mystic servant should prepare the necessary grounds needed for this. To gain these special blessings, the servant needs to avoid the company of those people with weak faith. The servant needs to avoid eating doubtful meals. The servant needs to purify the soul from vices and extreme lust. It is incumbent upon the true servant to avoid gluttony and too much sleep. These are the things that bring about dullness in worship and the death of humane spirit. That's what we were discussing.
My limbs for your service and sustain the strength of my hands to preserve in your service and bestow upon me the eagerness to fear you and constantly serve you so that I may lead myself towards you in the field with the vanguards who are in the fore rank and be swift towards you amongst those who hasten towards you and urge eagerly to be near you and draw myself towards you like those who sincerely draw themselves towards you and to fear you like the fear of those who believe firmly in you and that I may join the congregation of the faithful congregated near you.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we could never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
The value of worshipping is not completely known to us. We are in the narrowness of this world and we are unaware of many facts before the advent of the last day. Worshipping Allah leads to progress, leads to perfection and goodness. It leads to prosperity. It can make our life purified. That's how we can obtain the paradise. In this regard, the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, has stated about worshipping, أَفْضَلُ النَّاسِ مَنْ عَشِقَ الْعِبَادَةَ فَعَانَقَهَا وَأَحَبَّهَا بِقَلْبِهِ. The best man is the one who loves worshipping Allah in his heart, does it by his limbs. وَبَاشَرَهَا بِجَسَدِهِ وَتَفَرَّغَ لَهَا فَهُوَ لَا يُبَالِي عَلَى مَا أَصْبَحَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا and leaves other activities for it, not fearing worldly hardships. عَلَى أُسْرٍ أَمْ عَلَى يُسْرٍ. Then he continues, يَقُولُ رَبُّكُمْ يَبْنَ آدَمْ تَفَرَّغْ لِعِبَادَتِي أَمْلَأْ قَلْبَكَ غِنًا وَأَمْلَأْ يَدَيْكَ رِزْقًا. Your Lord says, O son of Adam, leave your activities for serving me so that I would fill your heart with independence. أَمْلَأْ قَلْبَكَ غِنًا وَأَمْلَأْ يَدَيْكَ رِزْقًا so that I would make your sustenance bountiful. يا ابن آدم لا تباعد مني فأملأ قلبك فقرا وأملأ يديك شغلا. Do not get far from me, otherwise I would fill your heart with need and your hands with engagement. On his ascension night to the heavens, the Almighty addressed the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam and said, يا أحمد ليس شيء من العبادة أحب إلي من الصمت والصوم. O Ahmed, do you know when the man is worshipping me? He said, no. Allah said, when he has seven features, a piety that prohibits him from unlawful, a silence that keeps him from saying what is not useful, a fear that increases his weeping from day to day, a humility by which he fears me in his privacy, and eating and drinking that is necessary for him, an enmity with the world because of my enmity with it, and a love for the righteous because of my love for them. This is the importance of worshipping Allah, that Imam Ali alayhi salam in this part of the supplication asked the Almighty Allah to give him the chance to do it in the perfect way possible. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Economic divide.
Imagine having to wait for hours for an emergency room. Then imagine there isn't a proper doctor to treat you. The NHS has some nightmare scenarios that it is dealing with for some time. But it appears that there are similar scenes in France and other European countries. And in the bigger picture, is Europe dealing with a social service crisis? That's what we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the highlights coming up in today's program. First, France's social services. Some of the factors plaguing it. Shortage of hospital staff. Also, emergency room wait times. They're very high there also. Benefits cuts is another factor plaguing the social services in that country. Then we take a look at a case study of the UK. Health services are deteriorating in that country. NHS, the national hospital there, shortcomings are glaringly shocking. And of course, a lack of government funding. Then social service and pension. In Europe, particular Western Europe, where there's a healthcare time bomb, there's shortages of pension funds also, and of course pension reforms that have sparked protests like in France.
For years, European nations and their nationals have hailed their healthcare and pension systems as an integral part of their social welfare system. But that is no longer the case. Rising costs across the continent have put pension, welfare, and healthcare systems under severe strain. France is a typical example. In that country, figures show that there are fewer doctors now than in 2012. More than 6 million people do not have a regular general practitioner or GP. 600,000 of them are suffering from chronic illnesses. 30% of the population does not have adequate access to health services. Germany is not faring better either. 35,000 care sector posts were vacant last year. That's 40% higher than a decade ago. Official reports say that by the year 2035, there will not be enough workforce to fill more than a third of all health jobs. There are reports of overcrowded casualty departments and parents forced to sleep in hospital corridors or travel hundreds of kilometers for a child's treatment. Even Finland will need 200,000 new workers in the health and social care sector by the year 2030. The social service situation in Europe is suffering in many respects, and there are special countries or certain countries that are suffering more than others. That's what we try to get at, taking a look at some of the social media posts. Our first post, why is Britain's health service, a much-loved national treasure, falling apart? Scenes that would, until recently, have been unthinkable have now become commonplace. Hospitals are running well over capacity. Many patients don't get treated in wards, but in the back of ambulances or in corridors, waiting rooms and cupboards, or not at all. It's like a war zone. So that was a website that we picked. The next post also is a website. It says, on life support, can France's struggling healthcare system be saved? It's pretty catastrophic. We don't have the adequate structure, neither the adequate conditions nor the adequate tools or enough staff. It's getting complicated. All right, this next particular post says, if you're a young person in Ireland, you now face the reality of needing a food bank, months to see a medical professional, insane car insurance costs, a rental crisis, one of the highest tuition fees in Europe, and now pension going up till the mid-70s. We should be protesting. Next, this is the protest in France over the government proposal to cut their benefits. In the USA, people seem resigned to having a blatantly shifty government full of millionaires taking all the benefits away just because they say so. And then finally, what many people are overlooking in these protests, France fundamentally lacks economic freedom. Big government policies over many decades have not resulted in benefits for the French people. And it says Emmanuel Macron has a rough ride ahead.
These protests, demonstrations, riots are going to continue across France for weeks, potentially months to come. So this is a huge problem for the French government, an out-of-touch ruling elite headed by Emmanuel Macron.
All right, so those posts, as you saw, and of course the websites had the UK and France being the focus, because that shows how extremely bad the situation is when it comes to social services and the health services in particular in those two countries. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of our Q&A in the program. Ranjit Brar is a medical doctor and political activist who joins us. Ranjit Brar, welcome to Economic Divide. My first question to you concerns France and the situation of the health services in that country. We just cited in one of our posts, social media posts, that said they don't have adequate structure, they don't have adequate conditions or adequate tools. This is based on a doctor in one of the hospitals there, or even enough staff. And it lacks permanent doctors altogether, long waits in emergency rooms for up to 48 hours. Is this a funding problem that's mixed with a shortage of staff?
Thanks so much for your question. I think it's both of those things. Fundamentally, there's a cost of living crisis, which is cutting across Europe. And we can discuss the reasons why that is, but it's a structural problem. You can see there's been a massive push in France in particular for pension reform and very large demonstrations over the preceding weeks. And we're looking like we're going to enter a period similar to the Yellow Vest movement, when the working class of France is very much pushing back against the restriction in their cost of living. France, like Britain and much of the European powers, are monopoly capitalist economies. They used to have a very great empire. They've got tremendous wealth based upon that. And the standard of living of our working class was based on what was called the post-war Keynesian consensus, named after the economist Keynes. And he essentially said it was possible to take a cut in the rate of profit in order to guarantee a higher standard of living for the working class. And that was followed throughout the developed Western world, so-called, which is really the imperialist world, the former imperial powers who maintained, even after they lost their direct colonies, a great deal of financial power and wealth, which we still see in operation today.
Okay, indeed. Of course, the colonial powers do rely on their past accumulations, so to speak. Now, Bob Gill joins us. He is an NHS general practitioner, so an appropriate person to have on this program. And he's also an activist for public health care. Bob Gill, welcome to Economic Divide. We're glad to have you as an NHS general practitioner. Obviously, your viewpoint matters. Problems of the NHS in the UK are much more pronounced than other countries in Europe. At least you can tell us if that's true. For example, a recent report revealing 220,000, that is, people a day are waiting at least 4 hours in the emergency room, with many others stuck in hospital corridors waiting for a bed. I mean, these are incredible. And you have a government under financial strain at the same time, which it doesn't appear to have the funds to allocate to fix the problem. But you see, they have dedicated £1.5 billion for the war in Ukraine. Is this a government funding problem, what's facing the NHS in the UK?
Yeah, it's a very important point. The problem is the political intention is to destroy the public health system, to persuade people to go into private health insurance. Now, you cannot break public trust and professional trust unless you make the health service struggle. So I'm afraid our government is using the avoidable pain and suffering and death of patients as a mechanism to persuade people to give up with the NHS. You point out quite rightly that money is being squandered elsewhere. When the pandemic struck, rather than building up NHS capacity, building up public health services, our government undertook the most expensive privatized outsourced pandemic response, handing over $37 billion to private companies, an accountancy firm called Deloitte, and Serco, an outsourcing contractor. This was money down the drain because it failed to help the pandemic response, and this money was lost to the health service.
Time now for the InfoNews section of the program, where we review some economic news from around the world. First up, taking a look at a topic we've covered many times before. It's about the dollar, in particular the petrodollar, and how it is has been issued a warning. Now, this warning came from a former White House official by the name of Paul Craig Roberts, in which he said the refusal to use the greenback for oil payments around the world could undermine the U.S. economy. That was his warning. Now, it came in reaction to Saudi Arabia's recent announcement that it was open to accepting payments for oil in currencies other than the dollar. So it's a news that's somewhat outdated, but the warning is not, coming from this particular former White House official. Next up, a worrying sign in terms of the central bank of the U.S., the Fed. It has risen the rates again. It has opted for a small rate rise, however, and at the same time, it has issued a warning of ongoing increases. Now, the Fed will keep its promise of more rate rises to come. Policymakers still highly attentive to inflation risks. So the inflation is still not being tamed the way that they want it to, and in particular, obviously, the Fed reacting to that. Now, this particular piece of news concerning Lebanon is really such bad news for the country that's suffering so much in so many ways. In particular, the currency in that country has been devalued. Its official exchange rate for the first time, an occurrence that has happened in 25, the first time in 25 years. So you can see how dire the situation is. And the amount, it has been weakened by 90%. So that's the amount of the devaluation. The central bank in that country has confirmed the new official rate, which is 15,000 pounds, the Lebanese rate of money per dollar, up from a little more than 1,500. So you can see how much it has been devalued by. Our look here is on the Russian economy based on this piece of news, of which the IMF has actually forecast for the economy of that country to grow faster than even Germany's and Britain for the year 2023, the year that we are in right now. IMF has said Russia's economy will likely outpace the UK, for example, that it will grow 1% this year higher than what has been forecast for the UK. So we can see that the war in Ukraine really is not affecting Russia, not only affecting Russia the way that they thought it would, but also the countries that are participants like the UK, Well, Russia's economy is even doing better than that.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us, and we will take a look at the state of EU social care as a whole when it comes to England, where it has been said it's never been so bad. Who has said that? Well, Sarah McClinton, who's the president of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, has said, and her exact words, the shocking situation is that we have more people requesting help from councils, more older and disabled with complex needs, yet social care capacity, well, it has been reduced. And also, we have 50,000 fewer paid careers based on what she has said. There you go. Alarm bells should be going off. Next, over 400,000 people actually rely on care homes in England. That's why we chose this topic for the in-depth section. And more than 800,000 receive care at home. But care services are struggling with 160,000 staff vacancies. Also, rising demand. In addition, already tight funding for social care, which is being squeezed by, guess what, soaring food and energy inflation. Then, more than 2 million hours of home care couldn't be delivered in the first quarter of this year, leaving unpaid careers at breaking point. Councils now are receiving 5,400 new requests for help. So that's a lot every day. So imagine that's not being met. All right? And then finally, the warning comes, all these warnings now come amid reports that the government is preparing to delay the introduction of an £86,000 cap on social care costs, a reform that was due to come alongside a new funding deal for councils that commissioned social care. Now, the calls from MPs and campaigners for an additional £7 billion a year from the Treasury to bring social care back into equilibrium, most likely that's going to be rejected, as the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, well, they are weighing public spending cuts and tax rises to fill an estimated £40 billion budget hole. £40 billion, they're coming up short, and that's a minimum. All right, let's bring back our guests and see what they think. We have Ranjit Brar, who's a medical doctor and political activist, who rejoins us. Ranjit Brar, welcome back to Economic Divide. When you take a look at the social care in England, it's never been so bad based on what we have just said. But what do you think when it comes to a ticking time bomb, as it's been called, in terms of healthcare being under threat across Western Europe as a whole? Basically, governments making promises, for example, about pensions that they can't deliver and even borrowing against it. What are the economic impacts of this from healthcare and benefit deficiencies to pension shortfalls?
Yeah, thank you. So there will be tremendous health impact. We are already seeing in our country as more and more, you know, large percentage of our poorest part of our population are not able to feed themselves, are not able to heat their homes, feed themselves adequately, heat their homes adequately. So it's already, we're seeing stories, individual stories of children who are dying in their homes, malnourished from black mold because of the damp, because their houses are not heated and they're not fed, which disgust us individually, but are, you know, symptomatic of a deeper problem. We know that perhaps as many as 5% of the British population essentially lack long-term secure housing. Not all of them are on the streets, but you know they're a hidden homeless population who are sofa surfing, have very insecure conditions, as a knock on their health. Excuse me. In terms of the long-term implications, you know, it's very much bound up with the fall of Britain as a financial power. We have lost a great deal of our productive economic capacity because Britain has exported capital. So it's been content to make greater profits from transferring the manufacturing part of our economy abroad. But of course, that depends on then being able to control that capital, countries abroad being content to have low wages, being content to have unequal treaties, being content that they themselves are drained of wealth. And as that breaks down, we're seeing that, you know, we are left with an ever larger section of the population who lack work, who lack social focus, who lack money. And of course, this inflation problem that, you know, the whole of Europe is facing, where inflation perhaps is going to reach 20%, means a huge reduction in the cost of living of all sections of the population.
All right. Obviously, the country UK that he mentioned there is something that is known, the UK, to be behind the G7 countries. Let's bring Bob Gill and see what he thinks, NHS general practitioner and activist for public health care. Bob Gill, welcome back to Economic Divide. I was just talking and asking the guest about this factor where you have a ticking time bomb when it comes to health care across Europe, whether that is actually an alarm that is as deep as it sounds, where you have governments that are making promises, for example, about pensions, and that's not even the most important factor, where borrowing is happening against it. And, of course, we're looking at the economic impacts when it comes to social services, whether it's health care, benefit deficiencies, or pension shortfalls. Is the situation that alarming?
Yeah, we have across Europe, neoliberal ideology, which is about removing public services, creating greater inequality, and actually reducing the tax bill for the rich. So we have billions of pounds that are not being collected from the super wealthy. We have energy companies that are profiteering on the back of self-harming sanctions, which have resulted from the provoked Ukraine-Russia war. So we have geopolitical and economic policies which are causing much harm and pain to most ordinary people. Now, if you do not tax sufficiently, if you allow rich people to get away without paying their fair share to society, well, then you can't pay the bills, and tax liabilities and public services are part of what, you know, we've got used to in a civilized society. Well, it seems that the governments of the UK and Europe are willing to sacrifice these basic public safety nets to pursue other goals which serve a very small minority of billionaires, oligarchs, and political representatives who are looking, it seems to me, after their own interests and not the interests of the public.
In Spain, officials say more than 700,000 people were waiting for surgery, and thousands of healthcare workers and GPs have held strikes to demand better working conditions. The crisis in the UK is even worse. Official figures show that about 20,000 people a day are waiting at least 4 hours in the emergency department. In December of 2022, 54,000 people in England had to wait more than 12 hours for an emergency admission, and the average wait time for an ambulance to attend a Category 2 condition, like a stroke or heart attack, exceeded 90 minutes. Britain, people can no longer rely on getting health care in an emergency, and they are paying more and more for a service that they increasingly cannot access as quickly as they need.
It's an untested, unthought through manifesto pledge that means that this existing workforce is going to be spread really thinly across a week, working unsafe hours, working up to 100 hours a week, leaving to a zombie doctor workforce on the shop floor, which is going to provide unsafe healthcare for its patients.
It's more about trying to show them that we do care, we're not going to take it lying down. We all love our job, and I don't want to move abroad. I don't want to give up being a doctor. I absolutely love it, but I think I don't know how much more we can take.
Experts believe across the continent, an aging population, more long-term illnesses, continuing recruitment crisis, and post-COVID exhaustion have triggered a crisis for Western Europe's welfare systems, and many believe the crisis is likely to get worse in the years to come. In a
one-third of the countries in the region, at least 40% of the doctors were aged 55 or over. And even when younger practitioners stayed despite stress, long hours, and often low pay, their reluctance to work in remote rural areas or deprived inner cities had created medical deserts.
In order to see how the social services of Europe is doing, it's necessary to see how it's doing as a whole. And that means looking at poverty and social exclusion. What is important is to see how European populations fared when it came to social care. When it comes to poverty and social exclusion, 1 in 5 people in the EU were at risk. In 2021, there were an estimated 95.4 million people in the EU at risk of poverty or social exclusion, which was equivalent to 21.7% of the total population. It's better also to take a look at the totals when it comes to the three categories. They are as follows: 73.7 million people were at risk of poverty, 26 million were severely materially deprived, and 29.3 million were living in a household with low work intensity. Now, let's take a look at countries that are most at risk of poverty and social exclusion. Please note that the countries with the most GDP, like France, Italy, Germany, and Spain, and their rankings that have the most people at risk of poverty and social exclusion. In terms of the world ranking, Britons now have the worst access to healthcare in Europe. Lengthy waiting lists are preventing millions from accessing the services they need, including social services. The first chart here shows the percentage of adults whose healthcare needs went unmet last year, with the UK ranking the highest. This chart shows the number of adults who could not access healthcare due to long waiting lists. And while we are on waiting lists, this piece of news was an eye-opener. And yes, it's about the UK, and it's truly shocking. Up to 500 people dying each week from emergency care delays. The bad flu season compounding systemic problems leading to unnecessary deaths. Some examples, long waits in the emergency room were linked to increased mortality, and some were between 300 to 500 people a week were dying as a consequence of the delays. A patient waiting 99 hours for a bed at Great Western Hospital in Swindon is one of the most extreme cases to date. This graph outlines how the UK is dealing with an emergency situation. The figures to have spiked here in 2021 and to not have subsided. And that does it for this segment of the program. Thanks for watching. Please send us your feedback. We really appreciate it.
The public social services, including healthcare in Europe, is suffering from a lack of government funding on the one hand. Then it's combined with structural deficiencies and then profit-driven companies, which are associated with the different sectors of this industry. Now, this probably means that these sectors will be privatized, which won't help the ones who are in need, which will probably mean more strike action, like we have seen across Europe, in particular in the UK. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to Economic Divide. For me, Kove Tahwai, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 49 meters (6040 kHz) for Europe and 25 meters (11,880 kHz) for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.